Wildwood Shopping Center at 2131 South Neal Street.
It's time to catch the beat for Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign, and Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. As always on WEFT, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I'm pleased to welcome to this week's show Amy Hassinger, local published writer with three established novels to your credit, and teacher in the creative writing program at the University of Illinois. You're also well known in town as the vocalist with the band The Jaybirds, who perform often. You have solid roots in a creative life. Let's start with your work teaching creative writing, since the new semester is beginning right now. Describe the creative writing program. Who are your students and what does the program offer?
Sure. So we are a smaller program housed within the larger English department. We have faculty in both fiction and poetry, and then those faculty also teach creative nonfiction, some of them. So we have strands where students who choose to major in creative writing can major in either fiction or poetry, but occasionally they might also choose to take a creative nonfiction class. And we have wonderful students. We've got students from all over the country, students who are interested in all kinds of creative activity, writing among them, certainly. We have students who are working in kind of a more of a straight literary style. And then we have students who are more interested in what we might call sort of more genre fiction and blends of the two. I teach fiction, so that's primarily where my knowledge is in terms of what students are up to in the program. I also teach creative nonfiction occasionally when that comes up. Our students can major or minor in creative writing. So we do get a significant number of students who are minoring and then might be majoring in another field entirely. You know, sometimes we'll have like physics majors who want to do a minor in creative writing, or engineers who want to keep their creative side, you know, alive and active. And so minoring in creative writing is a way that they might choose to do that. Classes start tomorrow, and I know that I have a good number of students in my, I'm going to be teaching a fiction workshop 3 class. So this is like the course number is CW404, and it will be the third in the sequence of fiction workshops. And I know that I have a good number of students in this class that I've had before. And so I'm looking forward to seeing them and reading their writing this semester.
How competitive is it to get into the creative writing program?
So the undergrad program, you know, I mean, it's you would get into the U of I and then you choose to major in creative writing. The grad program is certainly more competitive, but it's a very small graduate program. So we only accept 3 students in each genre every year. So that means we accept 3 poets, 3 incoming poets, and 3 incoming fiction writers. It's a 3-year program. So at any one time, that means we have 18 students in the program any one time. We'd like to call it kind of a boutique program for that reason, you know, because it is so small. And the students get to know each other very well, spend a lot of time together. One thing I didn't mention earlier was that we also, in the program, we host a lot of visiting writers. And these are readings that are open to the public. For example, we have a writer named Leland Chuck coming in October. He is a fiction writer primarily, so he's going to be coming to campus and talking with our students about writing fiction and then reading from his own work. He writes novels and short stories. We've also got Carmen Jimenez, who is primarily a poet. She's going to be coming in September, September 18th. I believe she's coming as part of the Pygmalion Festival, actually. And so she's going to be reading at Cranert. Yeah.
Pygmalion has quite a few writers coming this year.
They often are featuring writers. I mean, I think that's part of their vision, you know, that it's music and writing and kind of creative arts generally locally. So yeah, it's great. We're very lucky that you know, we have that in this community.
So you work very closely, I would imagine, with each student in your class. Are they generally working on a project, like a long fiction piece?
Well, it depends on the student. My undergrads are generally working on short stories. In my class, that would be anywhere from 8 to 20 pages, double-spaced usually. And typically in a fiction workshop, I'll have them write two of those, you know, full short stories. So a story with a complete arc that has well-developed characters and something interesting happening. And then they'll do, you know, shorter writing exercises typically at the beginning of the semester to kind of warm up and get some ideas. And the classes themselves are, again, if we're speaking solely about the fiction workshop, the students read each other's work and critique each other's work. So it's very intense discussion among the students in the class about each other's creative work, which is really, I think, a unique experience at the university and something that students really value quite highly, you know, that it asks them to engage very intensely and seriously with the work of their peers and to really collaborate with each other in the creative act. You know, it's not that others are writing, you know, the story for, students aren't writing the story for each other, of course, but it's kind of a collaborative imagining together of what this story might yet be and what the story is already doing that's really exciting and engaging, and then how the writer might more fully realize, you know, their vision. So that's the idea behind the workshop. And that's true in both the undergrad and graduate workshops. In the graduate program, some students are working on novels, and some students are also primarily writing short stories and working on those. It's funny because I think just because of the structure of workshop, it's almost easier and maybe more productive to workshop a complete short story than it is a chapter of a novel. Because if it's just a chapter of a novel, you don't have the whole thing in front of you. And so it can be harder to respond as a reader to something that's just a section of a larger piece. Whereas if you have a full short story, you have the whole arc, you have something that's complete in front of you, even though it may not be, there may be more revision ahead, it's complete enough that you can kind of respond to what it's trying to do artistically. Nevertheless, sometimes we do also workshop parts of novels.
And your students do have open readings for the community occasionally, right?
Yeah, they're great fun, actually. Lately, they've been having them. This last year, they've been having them at the Gallery Art Bar, which is a really great location for these readings and for all kinds of community events, really. They've been doing all kinds of exciting stuff over there. So it's usually once a month. It's a series called the Voice Reading Series. It's organized and run solely by the graduate students. And they kind of rotate. So typically each graduate student will read for about 15 minutes, I think, once a year. And there'll be like three readers on a given evening. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You can come and, you know, have a drink and sit and listen to some original work by our wonderful grad students who are really, really terrific and dynamic artists.
It's a lot of fun to see the energy that they bring and their interactions with each other. So I have enjoyed that a great deal. And this community, Urbana-Champaign, is a community with a lot of writers in it. And you have occasionally given courses in the community. I've taken a few and gotten a great deal out of them. And a lot of people here think about, what does it mean to be a writer? Let me ask you, in your writing life, because you also do your own work. You work on novels. You have a lot of essays out there. How do you regard your own writing life? How do you use your time and your creativity, your focus to do the writing that you want to do?
It's always a tricky balance, I will say, you know, especially once the semester starts up because it is so busy. But I make a point of I set aside time every morning, even if it's just a half hour. Usually I try to do a couple of hours, but every weekday morning I am trying. There are some days it gets away from me, but I try to touch my own writing in some way. You know, sometimes there are things that I have to write for, you know, if I'm applying for a grant, for example, or something like that. But most often I'm working on my own creative work. Really, ever since I kind of decided to be a serious writer way back in my 20s, that's the only way that works for me, is just regular coming to the page day after day, because inevitably you have days where nothing good is happening on the page, you know, and you just have to kind of get through those days in order to get to the good days. I've found, especially with longer projects like novels, but really with anything I'm working on, that process of entering the piece, entering the world, if it's a piece of fiction, entering the imaginative space, spending time there, making some progress, whether in a first draft, maybe it's you're doing a lot of exploration of who these people are that you're creating, you know, and what their lives are about, what the landscape is like that they exist in. If it's an essay, you know, maybe I have been working a lot in nonfiction lately and re-entering my own memory, you know, and trying to dredge up stuff that can take some dredging, but entering that creative space and then the stepping away from it that I do, I come to the end of my writing time and it's time to go teach or it's time to do the next thing. The stepping away from it is almost as important, I would say, as the actual writing. You know, I find that if I am working every day, that my unconscious will work for me even when I'm not sitting in front of the page. So often it'll be like walking to class after I've just been working on something for a couple of hours that an idea comes to me, you know, and I've got to make a voice memo on my phone or something, or walking my dog later in the day. For me, there's something about, in particular to walking actually, but there's something about like the physical movement, actually stepping away from the intense focus of what happens when you're working with language on the page, and then letting things filter a little more, you know, with a little bit more of a diffuse attention to the work, that solutions to problems, you know, might bubble up, which is great because you know that, okay, tomorrow I can go back and apply this new idea that I have. So yeah, the regularity I find to be really important.
Your three novels, Nina, Adolescence, The Priest's Madonna, and After the Dam, are very different in story, in storyline. They all have a very strong female protagonist, a teen in one case, and then, you know, one is historical fiction and one is more about motherhood and environmental issues. I was really stunned by how different they were from each other. How did the inspiration for those, to go into a novel, which is a project that you're going to be working on for years, how did you come to the subject for these?
It's true. People often notice that they're so different. And I think the reason for that is that really at heart, for me, one of the main reasons that I write is because I love to learn. I love to explore. And so with each book, for me, I think of it as kind of an opportunity to dive into a new area of knowledge and understanding. So with Nina, my first book, Nina Adolescence, I wrote that I actually wrote that when I was in graduate school. I was in my late 20s and not so far from adolescence myself. it was close enough that I could still remember what it felt like to be a teenager. And in particular, wrestling with or just kind of meditating on what it means to awaken to one's own sort of sexuality and kind of sexual power as a young woman. For a lot of young women, that experience can feel very heady and very confusing. Suddenly there's this feeling of lots of eyes on you. I mean, male attention, typically, that didn't happen before. The female protagonist, the girl, Nina, who is 15, offers herself up as a subject for her mother's portraits. Her mother is an artist. And she does this because her mother has fallen into a debilitating depression because of the loss of Nina's brother. This is kind of a desperate gesture. Like, if I give myself as a subject for my mom to paint me, then maybe she'll wake up again to the world. And it works in the sense that Marion, the mother, does, and she paints a series of portraits of Nina. But what ends up happening in the book is that these portraits then attract the attention of predatory art critic who Nina becomes embroiled in a destructive relationship with. The territory that that book came out of was the emotional experience of feeling like you're suddenly on display as a young woman. And in the book, that translated into these images of Nina, the portraits of her on the wall of the gallery, that quite literally meant that she was on display to the viewing public, came to see the portraits. Part of what got me thinking and imagining this storyline was the photographic work of the photographer Sally Mann, who is a wonderful photographer, and there was a series of photos that she took of her own young daughters who were kind of exploring their own, it looked like, in the photos anyway, that they were sort of exploring their own sexuality, but, they were the age of maybe 9, 10. Photos were, could look fairly provocative. And so I was kind of interested in exploring that line between what do we consider to be art, and where is the line between art and maybe exploitation of a subject? Where does one begin and the other end? That's where that book came from. The Priest Madonna was totally different territory. That's a historical novel, as you mentioned, that's set in the foothills of the Pyrenees around the turn of the 19th century. And that story I got interested in because a professor of mine that I had when I was in graduate school at the University of Iowa, James Allen McPherson, who was himself an amazing writer. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his short story collection, Elbow Room, way back in the day. He mentioned just in passing in one of our seminars a story about the kind of love relationship between Mary Magdalene and Jesus. And I had never heard about this. I grew up in the Christian tradition. I went to a fairly liberal Protestant church growing up, and I grew up in the Boston area. So I had grown up with these stories, but I'd never heard of the idea that there would be a romantic relationship between Mary Magdalene and Jesus. So that really intrigued me. And I kind of went to read more about it and discovered a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was an interesting book. It kind of teased out ideas related to that legend. And it's been so many years since I've read it, I'm not even going to attempt to try to summarize the book. But through reading that book, I learned of a story of this priest named Béranger Saunière, who lived at the turn of the 19th century and was of some interest because he became mysteriously wealthy. And he had a housekeeper named Marie Desnarnaud, who It was called in the town the priest's Madonna. They were rumored to have a romantic relationship, the priest and this housekeeper. And I just got really kind of interested in their story and like the overlaps with the legend of maybe possible love relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So that book primarily through the point of view of Marie, the housekeeper, and then it's also interwoven with, you know, my own imaginings from Mary Magdalene's life and her relationship with, in the book, it's not Jesus, it's Yeshua, the Hebrew name, that I guess I'll leave it at that for that book.
You told me that you have been thinking about attention and how difficult it is to hold attention with the onslaught of media and information and distressing information. I would imagine that you talk to your students about this. What are your thoughts about how to preserve your creativity in this world where we're barraged all the time?
It's something I think about all the time because I myself struggle with it. I think we all struggle with it now, right? I mean, we are, as you said, completely barraged. It's constant. And we're so many of us, I would say, argue probably most of us are addicted to our devices in one way or another. In order to preserve the time that we need as writers, or, you know, really, I think anybody trying to do anything creative, you know, you need this focused time that is not interrupted. We have to find ways to resist that. I don't think I have any miraculous answers other than I think it's a constant battle. Lately, I've been reading a couple of books. I'm right now reading Chris Hayes's book, The Siren's Call. I read a little earlier this month, Cal Newport's book, Digital Minimalism, which I found really useful. It's kind of a self-help book, but you know, he gives some useful ideas about how to cut back and like develop a philosophy of technology, you know, not to just go immediately to the tool, the technological tool, if it's not the best tool for the job that you're trying to do. So there's a lot of people thinking about this issue right now. I really like the metaphor that the theorist D. Graham Burnett uses, which is that the attention economy is basically fracking our brains. You know, I mean, I think that's exactly right, that we live in this attention economy right now. And attention is this precious resource that is arguably like the essence of who we are. What we pay attention to is the content of our minds, you know, and if we are not in control of that, then we are offering up something essential about ourselves to companies that are selling that real estate for advertising for profit so that they can make money. So something I've been thinking about a lot and really trying in my own life to minimize, you know, to not just sort of habitually go, I've got thing in front of my face, let me pick up my phone and look at it, you know, for no reason whatsoever, to try to be more mindful of how I'm using technology. And it's a battle because, like I said, I mean, I'm as addicted as anybody else. I don't want to be. I find that when I do carve out mental space, like I've been trying to do very more consciously the past couple of weeks, boy, does it feel good. It's like I can hear my own thoughts. Wow. I'm actually thinking things. It makes a difference.
Let me touch on the last major visible part of your creative life, which is your music. And I remember being astounded a number of years ago, because it's been quite a while that the Jaybirds have been together and performing, that you, as a writer, teacher, mother, decided to do this thing that is, it's a wonderful contribution to the community. I love your music. How does that feed your life and your writing life? And what brought you to start a band?
So my fourth book, which is not out yet, but is written and fingers crossed will be hopefully out in the world before too long, is a memoir about this very thing. In my early 40s, which is a while ago now, Cope. I won't say exactly how long. I decided, you know, I had always been a singer. I had never learned to properly sing jazz, and jazz is like my just, I love jazz music. Fell in love with it in college and always wanted to learn how to sing it. And in my mind, what that means is learn how to improvise. It always terrified me, the idea of improvising musically, improvising vocally. And so I went to a jazz combo class at C4A here in Urbana that was taught by my dear friend, Josh Houchin, who is now the bassist in the Jaybirds. It was a great class. It was really fun. We basically just played and sang, and I didn't know what the heck I was doing, but I enjoyed this totally other kind of creative outlet. I think that was part of it too, that if I felt frustrated with my writing, which, you know, is a part of the writing life, there's a lot of frustration, it felt good to be able to go somewhere else and do another creative activity that felt maybe a little lower stakes for me. And so it just sort of evolved from there. You know, I think that maybe a year later or the next semester, our guitarist now, Young Kim, joined the class also to have just an outlet, you know, people to play with. Young has his doctorate in jazz performance, so he's very accomplished as a musician. And so we kind of hit it off and decided we would try to start a band together. And we went from there. You know, for a while we had Steve Meadows playing drums with us, and now we've got Howie Golub, who plays percussion and harmonica and also sings. I love it. You know, I love the music. I have a great time with the guys in the band. They're all really terrific people. Going back to talking about exploring and always wanting to learn, this is an area where I feel like I still have so much learning to do, and I love the learning, and I love the opportunity to get to just try it out. It continues to be scary to me, but sometimes I like living on that edge of, let me push myself creatively and see what happens.
Well, you certainly put yourself out there. I want to thank you for having this conversation. Is there anything else you would like to say before we wind up?
Thanks for being interested in talking with me. And I so much appreciate what you do in the community, Cope. You're just a wonderful creative thinker and person yourself, and you know, all of your involvement in community events, I really appreciate. And I'm also glad to be back connected with WEFT. I did my own little podcast on WEFT for a while, The Literary Life. That was
you
years
did.
Ago. And I guess that's it. Just okay. Thanks. And thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. I give a hearty thanks to Amy Hassinger, Urbana resident, one-time WEFT airshifter with her own public affairs interview show, The Literary Life, and known around the world for her three novels, which have received numerous awards and been translated into Dutch, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Russian, and Indonesian. Visit her website, amyhassinger.com, to sample the nonfiction essays she has published widely, including the New York Times and the Los Angeles Review of Books. This interview is one of a series I'm enjoying to capture a bit of the spirit, motivation, and daily discipline of living a creative life. I will be interviewing noted painter, teacher, and muralist Glenn Davies next, and following that up with a conversation with renowned translator Jane Kuntz on what it takes to transform a literary work of art into another in a different language. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. You can also listen to live stream and archive shows on the WEFT app, available at your favorite app store. We'll be entering our fall pledge drive on September 19th and wrapping it up with our annual WEFT Fest on Sunday, September 28th. Beat the crowd and visit our website at weft.org and push that donate button. Then come out and enjoy an afternoon of music and birthday cake with us on Sunday, September 28th from 2 to 6 on Market Street and in the Seven Saints patio. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.